You're listening to KXRY Portland on 107.1 FM, 91.1 FM, and streaming online at xray.fm. I'm Sarika Mehta. Welcome to Intersections Radio, a new independent podcast, which also airs on X-Ray. Intersections Radio is the show where we geek out on all things intersectionality. Today, I'm airing a special feature on the political social media campaign, Crip the Vote. I should tell you now that today's episode will run longer than usual and into the next show's block. Crip the Vote is a nonpartisan campaign that was started on Twitter to both engage voters with disabilities and encourage politicians to have a national conversation about disability rights. I spoke with three disability rights advocates, our mighty advisor, Alice Wong, who was joined by Greg Barton and Andrew Pullring. The three are the masterminds behind the social media campaign, Crip the Vote. They host Twitter chats over various issues and post the data-driven results online afterwards. In fact, some of these issues have made it to the primary campaigns, such as the subminimum wage issue and gun violence, which is typically blamed on mental illness. I spoke with Alice Wong, Greg Barton, and Andrew Pullring on Skype about Crip the Vote and the world's largest minority, the disability community. We started the conversation with the genesis of the Crip the Vote campaign. This is Intersections Radio.
Barton, I guess it started, we were all part of the, you know, the disability community online, and we were watching these events take place in the campaign, you know, over the last however many months, and the absence of disability in anything, including issues that should logically bring up disability, just sort of overwhelmed us, and we started talking about, you know, what we could do.
Yeah, this is Alice. I think Greg was the one who sent a message to Andrew and me, you know, really proposing some sort of online campaign. And things happened around late December or January, and after just a really several conversations about what it would look like, what we would do as our first thing, and the name of it, it all kind of shaped up pretty easily.
Yeah, this is Andrew Pullring. That sounds to me like what happened, and I know I was looking forward to primaries to start, because that was, we kind of started it before, really, I think before the first primary, or maybe just right after, but in the very beginning. And I know I was anticipating, I know what a primary is like, and wondering if this would be a year when disability would be covered more, or how much it would be, and not knowing yet if it would be or not. And I liked the idea of using Twitter and a hashtag to try and encourage some kind of activity, whether or not the candidates were doing anything, without having to convince anybody to do anything, that we could make some activity. And that really appealed to me too.
Yeah, and this is Alice. I think there is something about, you know, having a loose, we're not even an organization really, we're just three people with an idea, and we, you know, create these, schedule these events on Twitter, and they don't happen with a regular frequency. We don't mandate that we're having monthly chats. You know, these really come organically due to, you know, events, our ideas, and our availability, and what people with disabilities are telling us. So we've received, you know, so much rich feedback and really amazing stories from people on Twitter using that hashtag. Like, it's really just gratifying to hear that, hey, I registered to vote today after the chat because, you know, you guys reminded me, or things like that, or, hey, I'm going to attend a caucus for the first time, and I'll let you guys know how it goes and what the access is like. That's really incredibly exciting to know that we're having a small impact, whether or not the, you know, candidates are listening. I think we just, that's pretty much would be icing on the cake. But the fact that our community is getting a lot out of it is really big.
And to see where the community has taken it has been incredible. So, I mean, I was just looking on the hashtag now, and there are a couple people that have been tweeting various congressional candidates and
yes.
asking their positions on issues like the Disability Integration Act or sub-minimum wages, and starting to see candidates actually respond, which is fantastic.
That's definitely something I wanted to talk about in a moment. I wanted to go back for 1 second and talk about some of the Twitter chat events that you've hosted. For example, the Voter Disenfranchisement, Accessibility, and Suppression chat. First, talk about how the Twitter chat functions as an effective form of activism, and then maybe go into some of the events.
Andrew, do you want to take that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I would like to say I'm fairly new to Twitter myself, whereas Alice and Greg, I think, are more experienced. So what I've found is that it works very well for a somewhat open-ended conversation where there is engagement between people, but it is more of an open forum, almost like an open mic, where people will say a thing and everybody hears it. And they might interact on it, but they might not, and that's okay. And the real impact comes by reading through all of them, or even skimming through all of them afterwards, and seeing the range of things that people were saying.
So what is an example?
Alice has put together, after each of our chats, storifies of the chat. So there are these sort of one website where you can collect all the chats together.
This is Alice. I'm looking at my Storify account right now, and we've had about 5 chats so far, and our first 2 chats took place right before a Democratic debate and a GOP debate, and those, as our first chats, were really much more open-ended, so it was more about, like, what are the issues you care about, you know, tell us about what matters to you, what do you want to see in this GOP debate, what do you want to see from this Democratic debate, and just, you know, really having us kind of understand what people are interested in and what their stories are. And then Andrew had a great idea about creating an online survey. So not only is CryptoVote very much about engagement on Twitter, but we're actually collecting data as well. And our third and fourth chat was about specific disability policy issues. And that's been really a rich kind of area where we talked a little more in depth about healthcare, employment, some minimum wages, you know, all sorts of things that should be part of the broader conversation with the election. And the fifth one that you already mentioned about voter suppression, voter ID, and disenfranchisement, which was really neat because we had 3 guest hosts that really added a lot to the conversation.
I noticed on the Storify websites that you did talk about some of the data, some of the numbers of responses and percentages and things like that, which is really remarkable. Can you tell me some specifics about the responses or the remarks and comments made during these Twitter chats, for example, in this voter identification and suppression Twitter chat?
Yeah, Andrew here. I think one of the things that I learned from it was, as somebody who comes from a primary state, not a caucus state, an example is we heard so much about the inaccessibility of caucuses. Not just the usual argument that caucuses are sort of inherently problematic and undemocratic, but specifically that they were especially hard for people with disabilities. I mean, I've been in disability in some fashion. I've had disabilities all my life, worked for disability issues for over 20 years, and it literally had never really occurred to me that caucuses were a huge problem for people with disabilities, but a lot of the people spoke up about that. Mm-hmm. So that's an example of an issue that I think rose to the top that I didn't expect. I don't know about the others, but...
Yeah, and this is Alice. I think on the topic of voter ID, we had S.U. Smith, who's a freelance journalist, and S.U. recently published an article about voter ID and how it impacts people with disabilities. And, you know, because so many people with disabilities are poor and may not have the luxury or the effort to get a photo ID, they are definitely impacted in the states, over 33 states now, that require some sort of ID when you vote. So that's definitely not in the conversation when you see in the mainstream media articles about voter ID and disenfranchisement.
The thing that interested me was, as Alice said, the voter ID stuff. I mean, you know, things that came out were things about, you know, how difficult it can be to get ID and some of the hoops that states are making people jump through to just get access to the polling place. In some ways, that's been the most enlightening thing for me, just hearing the richness of people's own accounts and their own relation to this election. And, you know, not only particular candidates, although we've had things about that as well, even though we're nonpartisan, but just hearing just the range of experiences people have had has been wonderful.
This is Andrew again. One thing I'd like to add is that another thing that came out of that particular discussion was a very interesting dual position, if you will, on accessibility versus absentee balloting. And it's sort of always been a bit of a puzzle or a conundrum in the community of, you know, if there are physical barriers or other barriers, do you kind of do what the traditional answer is, which is to just get an absentee ballot and be done with it? Or is that a cop-out and making it too easy on the system to not have to adjust? And the responses were so nuanced, and it was just amazing and wonderful. I mean, people were saying, in effect, it's important to be seen voting and going to your neighborhood polling place, and it's your right to do so, and it's important to be seen doing it as people with disabilities. At the same time, if you personally need to, then absolutely go get an absentee ballot. If it's between having an absentee ballot and not voting, get the absentee ballot.
People talked about how working with their local polling places, how they actually advocated to have an accessible polling place in their neighborhood. And they even talked about how what kind of assistance they received, either from a family member or the polling staff. So there's a lot of really great detail about the voting experience. Now, it wasn't all negative either. You know, a lot of people had really positive, and they really felt proud, whether it's absentee or in person. And one thing that emerged that, you know, I really picked up on was, you know, how you get a sticker that says, I voted afterwards. One person tweeted a photo of that on a wheelchair, and then somebody else tweeted, oh, I vote via, you know, absentee ballot. You know, I really wish we got a sticker too. And as a child of the 80s, I'm a sticker collector. And I thought, oh my God, we all deserve stickers because I also vote strictly by absentee voting. And I thought, wouldn't that be nice if they included that in the absentee ballot, like a little sticker so you can also show that you're part of the larger political process. And it should be the same kind of achievement. So as a result of this most recent chat, Greg, Andrew, and I decided we're going to create CryptoVote I Voted stickers. So we're going to come out with them.
And I registered.
Yeah. I registered, right. And I voted. So we really want people that, you know, be visible to show their pride when they vote or even register to vote. Because we all know it's one thing about voting, but a lot of people, you know, don't even register or think to register. So we're going to have these available on our The Disability Visibilities Project Zazzle store, and they're going to be available for any sort of community organization that with their voter registration efforts or anything about voting.
We've got a wonderful design by a member of the community who's participated with us from the beginning, Mike Mort, who actually created our logo, and then we went back to him and asked for a sticker and came up with a fantastic design.
This is what's like so delightful about this experience, is to connect with so many people and to have people really want to participate and want to volunteer and want to provide assistance. So this guy who just makes these beautiful graphics, he's disabled, he's really involved in the community, and I'm really thankful that he's willing to help us with this.
Well, this is really cool, and I appreciate that you understand the pride behind the sticker, and I appreciate that you talked about the visibility of voting across all different communities and minorities. I live in a state that is strictly absentee ballot, and I'm from Illinois originally, so I really miss going to the polling place. You know, I understand some of the barriers, and I recognize that, at least in the state of Oregon, this decision was made to increase voter turnout, but there is something to be said about seeing people voting, seeing all kinds of people voting, and I'm glad you brought that up.
Right, and I really think whichever side you go for, to me the remarkable and wonderful thing is the fact that people could advocate both at the same time, and people are sophisticated enough to realize that it's not either or, that there's importance at both sides of it, and that there are a lot of arguments for completely by mail system. Maybe we should all do that. And there are points in favor of that. You would lose the visibility, but you would lose it across the board. What we really object to, and what the community, the consensus was, that what's really unacceptable is to have other people with no difficulty at all to go and vote publicly and be seen doing it. Well, we are barred from doing that because of preventable barriers. Mm-hmm. That's the really unacceptable. Yeah. Whichever model you go for, it has to be fair.
And hearing the stories of people whose polling places have made that effort to be accessible and, you know, go out of their way to improve access for people they see, you know, year after year, shows how easy it can be if these, you know, areas and states and local communities make that commitment. It's not a lot of effort. It's, you know, choosing an accessible location and considering how access operates within that location.
And I think we still need to be also mindful that in-person and absentee ballots are still inaccessible to some people. So it's not just 100% easy breezy via absentee ballots. There are people with learning disabilities or visual disabilities that still cannot vote independently without assistance. And I think that's a really important thing to remember, that it's the ability to vote, but also to vote privately. So I think there are a lot of people in the blind community that are also advocating for online voting. And I think this is another really interesting idea. And if it's possible, and if it allows greater access and degree of independence while voting, I think that's the future. That's something we can all get behind.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to go back to what you were talking about initially. I can't remember if it was Andrew or Greg, about the movement has had such an impact that now politicians are actually starting to talk about disability in the primaries, in these debates and everything. So actually, can you give some examples? I know that the group is nonpartisan, and you know, I'm not using my show to endorse any given candidate, but I just want to give the listeners an idea of the discussion and the conversation that's taking place.
Sure. I mean, there's a candidate for Congress who just tweeted today that he's appalled by subminimum wages. His name's Jesse T. Smith. I don't know what party he's a member of, but he's running for Congress right now. And one of our members actually was tweeting various congressional candidates about their support for subminimum wages and DIA, and he responded. We've also had shout out from Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate. So it's been interesting to see candidates sort of casually engage either us or some of the other groups that are out there working on similar issues like Vote Disability or Rev Up. It's been really good to see that start to happen, although it hasn't happened nearly enough.
Yeah, it's Andrew. I think that is a good point to acknowledge that there are some other movements and other disability organizations involved in the campaign that are doing it in different modes. And some of the most notable changes or progress have been partly due to the Center for Disability Rights in Rochester, for instance. During the last few weeks when everybody was campaigning in New York State, they had people at rally events or town halls, and it kind of got things rolling by having people stand up and say, ask a question. Or I don't know if it was one of theirs, but anyway, it started the ball rolling.
See, them are adept.
Right. Like, I think it started with Hillary Clinton at one of her events. Somebody basically asked a question about subminimum wage, and she came out saying that she was against it, which is a pretty specific statement. And it sounds obvious, but you have to realize that there are people who would actually oppose being against it, which if you dig into the issue, you see that it's not completely uncontroversial. So it's not nothing to say it. And then that started a ball rolling of asking the other candidates, well, what about you? What about Sanders? What about the Republicans? And we've kind of participated in some of that by trying to amplify that with using the hashtag. And then the same thing happened with the Disability Integration Act, which is really a proposed law that would affect long-term care. And again, they got, I think it was Hillary Clinton at first, and then Bernie Sanders, and then trying to get the Republicans to give some response. So that wasn't happening, strictly speaking, under our banner. We didn't initiate that, but we were able to dive in and participate along with that. It's great.
It's really interesting seeing Clinton give a pretty well thought out specific response. And immediately after that happened, we saw a lot of reporters write articles about what is a minimum wage, you know, what are the issues, and what is the position of Clinton. And then later on, there were other people who were Democrats, which Sanders, and started tweeting, like, what about you, Sanders? What's your position? So it's having a domino effect in the media and among different supporters. And I think that's healthy to have this kind of back and forth. And we've, as a three of us, have been also just monitoring things online and just using the hashtag for various articles that we see that would contribute to this conversation as well. So people who talk about the voting experience, and, you know, we try to just quote tweet, and I use the hashtag just to loop it into this larger discussion.
It is pretty spectacular that it started a greater conversation with presidential candidates, because I'm pretty sure that was not a question that they expected on the agenda, asking about subminimum wages and things like that. I had a quick question. Why in the world is it not a controversial issue? Like, why would somebody be opposed to...
Parents.
Yeah, parents want to protect their kids, and they think, you know, think sheltered workshops are the way to go for that.
And there's a lot of nonprofits that they profit. I mean, it's their industry.
They depend on the exploitation.
They make their living. Their work of producing XYZ is dependent on this status, on this loophole. So there is a small, pretty strong local contingent of people that run nonprofits that are very, they are not happy about this idea of having to pay basic wages.
And I think it's important to note, and I wonder how many people, even on our side of it, understand the full dimensions. For what it's worth, it's not something that applies to a massive number of disabled people. In other words, it's not quite the same as saying any disabled person can just be paid less than minimum wage. It's supposed to be, quote unquote, for a very targeted group of people with certain kinds of disabilities that blah, 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 blah. You know what I'm saying?
And organizations have to apply to qualify.
Right. Right. I don't think any of the three of us could ever be qualified to be able to be doing that. And when Alice mentioned parents, you're talking about, a lot of times it's families with people who have what they perceive as very severe disabilities. And in their minds, if they didn't have this pennies an hour job at the local sheltered workshop, they would have nothing. So in their minds, us changing that is potentially the loss of their job. The shelter, the shop will close, and they look at the person they're in their family and said, well, I know that so-and-so would never be able to get a regular job, and you people are acting like they can. And it gets into a bunch of stuff.
And for me, you know, what bothers me is hearing the arguments that, oh, you know, this person enjoys this work, and it gives them something to do, and they're slower. So their pace and their productivity is not the same, so they shouldn't be paid the same. And to me, I feel like labor is labor. And that to me is where people don't understand. They still see these quote-unquote vulnerable, disabled people as if, like, this is a recreation versus actual labor, whether or not they can produce at the same rate as non-disabled people. That's even not the point. It's about the labor that they're contributing at that very moment. And that's, in my mind, clearly not valued.
And they have been abused, too, to where they do quite often go beyond that scope of what it's supposed to be for, the people it's supposed to be for. Whether or not the scope itself is justified, setting that aside, they go beyond it a lot. And a lot of these places end up being dumping grounds for people that are just hard to place. And that's never been what they were supposed to be for. So it's a corrupt system, and it's time it ended. It's been around since the 1930s. You know, it's just plain outdated.
Yeah. And if you think about it, is there any other group of people we would tolerate this kind of exploitation of? And I don't think you can say yes to that. I mean, I can't think of anyone.
I guess prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. Prisoners are definitely exploited for their labor, too. And that actually could be one point of solidarity. Maybe we could connect with people who are working toward prison reform, because they definitely are, they're working some minimum wages and under horrible conditions, too. But yeah.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate all of you clarifying that for me. And boy, that is definitely a discussion for a whole another episode. But you're right, it's outdated and exploitative. And that's very interesting that this made its way to presidential candidate.
You know, I don't think we could prove it, but I suspect that it's such a specific issue that I doubt that presidential candidates are aware of it.
Right.
And that's something that's true of a lot of disability issues. A lot of our issues are very specific and very nitpicky and very wonkish because they have to be. So it's not just enough to say, well, I support disabled people. Great. But do you know what that means and what that entails?
How does that affect your approach to Medicaid? And how does that affect your approach to SSI?
Yep.
I mean, that's what we need to hear.
Yeah, and at the same time, it's nitpicky. And yet, people with disabilities are 57 million Americans, and it's not a very small minority of the minority. So again, there's like both the specificity and also the broad number of people that are impacted. I mean, we think about so many people who receive Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and how some of the political rhetoric toward people who receive benefits and people who are living in poverty, it's really rather ableist, and I think there's a lot to be unpacked and a lot that we can hopefully let candidates know that a lot of this rhetoric is ableist, and whether they realize what ableism is or not, that can be something that if they wanted to engage with us, we'd be more than happy to share with them those experiences.
Speaking of this ableist rhetoric, and I'm not sure if this is something that Crip the Vote talks about or if this was another Disability Visibility Project issue, recently Governor Mike Pence of Indiana passed this abortion bill. What I'm getting at is disability justice kind of being used as a commodity or as a prop when it's convenient for politicians. So what happened is that he was using babies with Down syndrome as a way to garner support for this abortion bill.
I think the disability community has addressed it, and you know, we've certainly been a part of those discussions. I don't know that it's come up much under our chats or under the hashtag, but I mean, the disability community has called Indiana out on that largely. I mean, I think much of what I've seen has said, don't use us for your end, and recognizing that those ends have nothing to do with disability.
Yeah, like what Greg said, I don't recall many people using that hashtag in connection with this spread of legislation that's happening all over the country, but Indiana in particular. But I think one area that is similar to this topic that people definitely talked a lot about is gun control and the discussion of people with mental illness. So that is definitely a form of ableist rhetoric that we've seen by politicians, and we at Grip the Vote have definitely tweeted a lot about in our chats and in just everyday people using that hashtag to talk about. When you're talking about gun control, you mention these dangerous people, and you usually always, you know, cast it in the light of somebody with a mental illness. You need to remember that the majority of people with mental illness are the victims of crime and victims of violence rather than the perpetrators. So this is kind of the thing that I've seen in the pushback a lot, and this is something that we really care about.
And it's come up in every single debate. I mean, that, well, anytime the gun control question's been asked, we've had almost every politician cite mental illness in some way, and it ignores the reality of the situation. And I think it's angered our community incredibly.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that gun control / mental illness is a thing. The abortion and Down syndrome thing is a thing. There are some issues where disability positions can run against the grain on what people can have real conflicts, let's say. But of those conflicted areas where the disability community can be legitimately conflicted, what has come up has not been. In Crypt the Vote, some stuff has come up and some has not. And I take that as a sign of what people are choosing to think about and talk about and what's important to them. And as much as there's an issue with the abortion thing, that didn't really flow to the surface very much, whereas the mental illness and gun control thing absolutely did. And I think that's a sign of where the community wants to go, what's on our minds.
I would also say we've seen, you know, we've seen enough of the breadth of the community's political views to know that there's not agreement on many of issues like abortion or gun control,
right.
But they agree in their opposition to the ableism of blaming disabled people for gun violence. And so we've seen the community come together over these issues in a lot of ways that they wouldn't necessarily come together over those issues.
Another reason why the prenatal diagnosis bill, those bills, haven't come up to the surface is if Mike Pence was running for governor for re-election, I think that would have definitely contributed to more visibility in crypto vote. So he's already in office and passing a law. So I think, you know, Crypto Vote has been kind of focused on candidates and various, I mean, we like to also spread it to not just the presidential election, but also local elections too. But I think because Mike is the governor of, and unfortunately I need to confess, I am from Indiana. So it's incredibly, you know, it's not surprising to see that a law like this happen. And, yeah, so I think if he was running, if it was an election year for him, I'd personally be very interested in raising these issues as a crypto vote issue, and who knows?
That's a good point. And speaking of how the community is responding to some issues versus others, and obviously the disability community is not monolithic. In fact, it's phenomenally diverse. And so many intersectional identities and communities are underneath this umbrella. Do you ever struggle with reaching the community in vast numbers, or do you ever get any pushback from the community?
I think we do definitely make a point in our chats to keep these as intersectional as possible. So in our most recent chat about voter ID and suppression and disenfranchisement, we definitely had a question about how does this impact disabled people of color differently, and how does it impact trans or LGBTQ people with disabilities? So, you know, we try to always be mindful of that, not to just only focus on disability singular issues, that it really, there are so many other contexts and experiences that go into it.
Yeah, and there are a couple of folks who sort of on a semi-regular basis will remind us that, well, it's hard to say what they're trying to remind us of, but I think what they're trying to say, there are a couple of people who I think view themselves as being very much outside the political system because the political system is not fundamental enough, it's not radical enough, whatever, and sort of every once in a while reminding us to question whether we should be even bothering with this election thing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of interesting that they come, every once in a while they'll come out and say, hey, why are you even bothering with this? And sometimes they will also invoke sort of intersectionality in that. And I view that in almost as another kind of intersectionality, that it's a different, very different political community than your typical liberal versus conservative, but basically contesting traditional elections. You also have people who aren't really sure that even that elections are worth talking about.
Right.
And chiming in every once in a while and saying, hey, none of you are talking about anything that's really going to change anything. Blah.
For me, I mean, some of the most interesting pushback we've gotten has been around the name. There are people that weren't comfortable with it, but that pushback's been really good in that we've had some incredible conversations about the issue of reclaiming language, about the history of the word Crip, about who can use it and who can't and when and where. And that's led to even people that never came around our way of thinking, and we were always fine with that because there were other avenues, as we said, for expressing yourself politically in the community. But we had some fascinating discussions on language that came out of this and the disabled political experience. And this has been, in that sense, the pushback's been really helpful to us because it's forced us to articulate our positions and it's helped other people to understand their own.
And I think we've tried to, you know, articulate through our blog posts and tweets that, you know, we're not aiming to be everything to everyone. And I think we are, you know. It was deliberate in our decision to name it as Crip the Vote to really resonate with folks who do have at least some sort of disability identity. And, you know, unfortunately, I realized that also will be missing some people who may prefer other broader ways of talking about disability. So I think it's done deliberately. And we really do hope as many people join us and are welcome. I think that's part of it too, is that we would love to have a lot of different views and a lot of different folks, even if they have ambivalence toward the hashtag.
I just want to add, for what it's worth, that the one kind of conflict that I personally was most worried about, and it hasn't happened yet in any real amount, was actual conflict between the different candidates and their supporters. And we really haven't seen much. We've seen people who are clearly for one candidate or another. Sometimes they add their own hashtags from the candidates to whatever they're saying. So you can see clearly, or sometimes their avatars make it very clear who they're for. But beyond that, nobody's really getting into arguments about that. When they're using the hashtag CrypTheVote, they're more talking about issues and representation and fairness for voters with disabilities, whether they happen to have a Hillary-looking logo or a Bernie-looking logo or a Kasich or whatever. And that's really, to me, that's really impressive, too, that if people are kind of taking a time out from the conflict that is happening very much on the surface of things, and stepping back to talk about issues a little bit.
I think part of it is the way we kind of set the tone as well throughout our beginning of every chat. You know, we do remind folks that we love the passion that people have toward their particular candidates, but these chats aren't going to be about each candidate's platform. It's going to be about these larger issues. We do invite folks to join us, to talk to us but also to remain civil. In our every chat, we brace ourselves for some sort of conflict during the chats, and yet everyone's been really, really civil, and that's been really great. And I think that's why, you know, at the outset, we decided to be nonpartisan, and that's been really helpful too.
Even when we've been live tweeting debates, and people are clearly on one side or the other, the discussion's been incredibly respectful, and that's been wonderful to see, because I think everyone sort of recognizes, in the end, we're one community. Even if we have different political takes on various things, we've come together as a disability community.
And I also think what's fed into it is our belief that although there are probabilities of which parties and candidates voters with disabilities might support, you could draw some conclusions from that about our politics, but generally speaking, the disability space is actually wide open to any candidate of any party to stake out meaningful positions, and that we are open to any of the candidates appealing to for our vote. You know, whenever we're doing a tweet about, say, Hillary endorsed this position, what about you? It's not just Bernie Sanders we're tweeting. We're tweeting Donald Trump and John Kasich and Ted Cruz. So, again, there's a probability involved there of how likely is it, but, hey, we're open to it.
Again, I think it's we, you know, do various blog posts, and usually the ones that I publish, you know, we try to say, like, this is just one approach. There are a lot of different ways to create political change, social change, and we just happen to go through this route for this and keep it focused on political participation. But, you know, this is not the only way to go about it. So just to be mindful that there are a lot of different methods and a lot of different ways to be engaged.
It is impressive that this is a nonpartisan group. I mean, and that's what offers both sides of the spectrum so much opportunity to talk about these issues. And similarly, that the people who are involved, the people who are tweeting, who are in the disability space, that they are, you know, it's like you were saying, putting aside political differences to talk about these issues. It's fascinating. And it's nice to see, because we are inundated with a different style of covering the elections. Do you have any other remarks before we close?
Not really. I guess I just ask folks, people who are interested, just to use the hashtag on Twitter. And we have a Facebook group if anybody wants to read the latest news and updates on our campaign. So people can find out the latest by going to the hashtag or through our Facebook group.
I'd like to point out that on the Facebook page, too, we've been posting links to articles that we find that are about disability and politics and policy. So if you want to read, if you just want to read some stuff, that's another thing that you can do, is to go and visit and see what we've put up there.
And I know they're too modest to do it, so let me plug. Alice and Andrew have two of the best websites out there, the Disability Visibility Project and Disability Thinking. And besides having all our, we put all the Crypt the Vote stuff on both those websites, but they're also incredible sources of information, and I recommend anyone check those out.
Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
I will jump on that bandwagon. I've been utilizing both websites for sure. Thank you so much, Alice, Greg, and Andrew, for joining me on Intersections Radio. This was a really fascinating conversation, and I look forward to having more conversations beyond just our election year.
That'd be great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
That was Alice Wong, Greg Barton, and Andrew Polerang, the disability rights advocates behind the social media campaign Grip the Vote. Check out the Twitter hashtag or the Facebook page to learn more. To listen to the podcast of this interview, check out intersectionsradio.wordpress.com. Visit the same website for previous episodes of this podcast. And join the Facebook community at facebook.com/intersectionsradio. I'm Sarika Mehta, and this is Intersections Radio. Thanks for listening.